In 1978, the owners of the bread factory in Anchorage moved south to the state's capital, where they opened the Fiddlehead Restaurant and Bakery. Today, it's thought of as one of Alaska's finest eateries, serving about 100,000 people a year. And now, there is the Fiddlehead Cookbook, based on more than 150 of the restaurant's favorite recipes, some of which use the best ingredients nature has to offer an Alaskan kitchen. Today on Conversations, we'll talk with one of the book's four authors, wild edible expert Susan Brook, about her field, about the cookbook, and putting nature to work in the kitchen. Susan, the first question has to be the obvious one. The restaurant is named The Fiddlehead. The cookbook is named The Fiddlehead. Tell us where, when, and how to find a fiddlehead, and then in a little while, tell us what you do with it.
Well, you find fiddleheads in the spring. They're one of the first things to come up in the spring. And you look for them in moist places, maybe along stream banks might be a good place in Fairbanks, or under in shady, moist places. And in at least in Southeast and here, you would pick them when they're about 2 or 3 inches tall and the curled part is still very much tightly curled.
That's distinct for the fiddlehead, right?
Right, that's what gives it the name. It's like the fiddle head of the fiddle neck of a fiddle is where it gets its name from. And you go out and look. Usually they grow in clumps, so you can, if you find one fiddlehead clump, you'll probably find more in the same location. And what we do is go out and pick it in the spring, and we snap the fiddleheads off at the base. We don't pull them up by the roots, we just snap them off at the base. And the ferns, some ferns have a brown, chafy covering, and we take a knife or our hands and we rub off the chafe and try and make it as clean as we can. And then we wash it, take it back home and wash it. And if you have a microwave, they are really excellent. Just stick them in a microwave for, just a few seconds with a tiny bit of water. And they're really good that way, or just boil them or steam them the way you would asparagus.
You don't eat a fiddlehead raw?
You can. They're crunchy. Mm-hmm. But I think they're probably better steamed. They take a little bit of that little acrid edge off them. And frankly, they're excellent smothered in hollandaise sauce, something nice and rich and smooth like that.
So treat it like an asparagus then.
Right, like asparagus. Mm. They have sort of a woodsy overtone, more so than asparagus does, but you could pretty much take any asparagus recipe and treat your fiddleheads that way, and they'd be really good. Another way is to pickle them, too. Pickled fiddleheads, you could use a recipe that you might have for pickled vegetables and treat fiddleheads that way. And that way you can enjoy them in the winter.
Uh-huh. This is like a vinaigrette?
Mm-hmm, yeah, right, a vinaigrette, maybe some onions or a hot chili or two. And they're pretty versatile.
In the cookbook, the recipe that got me was just for an accent, using fiddlehead ferns to accent an eggs benedict with smoked salmon mm-hmm. instead of ham.
Right.
Sounds marvelous.
Yeah, that sums up springtime in Southeast is you get smoked salmon and sourdough English muffins and go out and pick fiddleheads and steam them up and make a hollandaise and then invite your friends over for brunch with fiddleheads and smoked salmon. It's really about the biggest springtime treat I can think of.
Sounds wonderful. The Fiddlehead Cookbook is our subject today on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. Susan Brook, our guest today, was raised in Hillsdale, Illinois. She was attracted to the forest. Her education gives her a B.S. in forestry from Utah State University, and then she came to the University of Alaska Fairbanks for a Master's of Science in Natural Resources Management. We'll hear more about Susan as we go along. It seems to me that cooking is equal and unequal parts of attention to details and patience and then intuition and a bit of the scamp. What's cooking to you?
That's what brings you to the kitchen? That's an interesting question. I guess for myself, I've never known whether it was my interest and love of plants that led me to cooking and eating or whether it's my interest and love of cooking and eating that led me to plants, but so for me, the two are pretty much intertwined, and I can't really say which is more important because to me, you have to have both. And as far as the art goes, I think that's something that some of it you maybe inherit from your mother. Mm. Some of it may be just experimenting with wild food and seeing what tastes good to you. And I think that's one thing that the Fiddlehead Restaurant does so well is they take the local ingredients and treat them in new and different ways, and it just takes something fairly commonplace and makes it real special. I think that's why that's the sign of a true cuisine.
When did you start harvesting the wild? What do you remember first?
Boy, first I probably remember, when I was getting my forestry degree, part of the course was to take a lot of plant identification classes, and Utah, of course, is covered with sagebrush, and I remember going on camping trips and using sagebrush, the leaves of sagebrush as seasoning and food, and that was not a big hit. I don't recommend that to anyone. But I hung in there, and I kept trying, and my friends kept putting up with me, and I just, as you get more experienced and you learn where to look for the choice edibles, I think you just grow and develop over the years.
I think most people in Alaska who would not consider themselves wild edible gatherers do frequently go out, and what they go out for is berries. We have a tremendous well stock of berries in this state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Fairbanks, I have happy memories of when I lived in Fairbanks, and I lived off Belaine Road up in Muskox Subdivision, and I remember going with my dog and just wandering around and foraging for berries and the little lowbush cranberries and the little lowbush blueberries and the highbush cranberries and rose hips later on in the year. And there, you don't have to, in Fairbanks, you don't have to go very far to find something that's edible and really pretty tasty.
Let's talk about the highbush first. It's not a true cranberry, I have read.
No, it's not at all. It's a viburnum, which is a shrub that most people know from their gardens. Viburnums have white flowers, kind of snowbally type flowers, and leaves like maples. And the wild highbush cranberry is a species of viburnum that grows in the wild. And generally in Fairbanks, they're found in birch stands, open birch stands, and maybe some mixed spruce and birch stands. And around the university, you find them quite a bit in the arboretum, which surrounds the university. But to me, they're a real typical fall. When you walk through the woods in Fairbanks in the fall, you get sometimes it's sort of a musty, skunky odor, and that's the highbush cranberry. And it can smell pretty terrible, but when you preserve it in a jelly or make a sauce out of it, it's just heavenly.
I was surprised to find in the book's recommendations how many things you can use the highbush for. I mean, the normal you would think of, syrups, juices, and jellies, but cocktail sauces, Louis dressing for salads, catsup,
right.
Chili sauce.
It's a wonderful all-purpose berry, I think. In my business, which is making wild berry jams and jellies and preserves, it's my ace in the hole because I can use it so many different ways in ketchups and chutneys, and you can use it as in a cocktail sauce, or you can use it on meat or fish, or it's a berry that I think more people could easily learn to love, and it's so abundant too that you don't feel like you're taking the last highbush cranberry in the world when you harvest it.
Okay, now the chef is on the spot. Pick out of your mental bag a wonderful, relatively unusual recipe that people could listen to over the radio using a highbush cranberry.
Well, gosh, without a recipe, the first, just to make highbush cranberry syrup for pancakes is really a treat, and that's simply taking highbush cranberries, gathering them up as many as you want to or as many as you can find, putting them in a pan and maybe just a little bit of water and letting it come to a boil, and then taking the berries in a cheesecloth and then letting the juice, actually you'd probably steam them for 10 or 15 minutes, and then gathering the berries up and extract the juice, and then you take the juice and add probably equal amounts of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's too thin, then you just boil it down until it gets thicker, and you just add sugar to taste. Some people like highbush cranberry is fairly tart, and some people like it much sweeter. And you can also add orange juice is a real good thing to put with highbush cranberries, or ginger even. A little bit of ginger really brings out the kind of the woodsiness of the highbush cranberries.
Even in a syrup, you'd put a little
mm-hmm.
ginger in?
Yeah.
Or a little orange?
I make a jelly that's highbush cranberry jelly with ginger, and you could put it in a syrup, or something about the sweet, hot warmness of the ginger brings out the tartness of the cranberry.
Highbush cranberry. The most important thing about this is to take the seed out.
Right, take the seed out. Right. And that's probably the hardest thing you'll have to do is just take the seed out. And that's why if you make syrup, you're not worried about the seed anyways because it's not part of your syrup. And so highbush cranberries are definitely something that people should learn more about.
The Fiddlehead Cookbook is what we're talking about today. How did the Fiddlehead Cook come about? Did people just keep saying, what's your recipe for this and what's your recipe for that?
Well, that's a good portion of it. The Fiddlehead, when we first started this, had been open for 10 years. And Deborah Marshall, the owner, had been looking in her file of people who over the years had requested recipes. And it just seemed like that as a nice celebration of 10 years that now was the time to do a cookbook. And we were fortunate in that St. Martin's Press sales representative, who comes through Alaska on his sales trips, was a real fan of the Fiddlehead. And so he put us in touch with the editors back in New York. And I will have to say the response was underwhelming. We didn't hear back from them for weeks and weeks and weeks. And we finally sent them some Alaska ingredients like smoked salmon and spruce tip syrup and sourdough starter and a few of the Fiddlehead recipes and asked the person we'd been contacting, hey, you know, just try making some of these recipes and see what you think. And so she made cranberry muffins that's in the cookbook and made them for the editorial board, and they were sold. And that afternoon we got a call saying St. Martin's Press wanted to negotiate with us. So I think, you know, that speaks well for Alaskan ingredients.
A cookbook that went in through the palate. That's very
That's right.
Nice.
The way to St. Martin's heart was through their stomach.
The Fiddlehead cookbook came out in November of 1991. It is a St. Martin's publication. This book has 150-plus recipes, Oriental, French, Italian, Mexican, vegetarian, Alaskan foods, quotes from people as diverse as Oscar Wilde and M.F.K. Fisher and Mae West. Lots stacked in a little book. I don't want to leave berries. There is a recipe for highbush cranberry apple butter in the Fiddlehead Cookbook. This sounds just delicious. Can you give us a kind of an oral view of highbush cranberry apple butter?
Well, it's something that would be great to serve at holiday feasts with poultry, with ham. It's one of those, I'd hate to, calling it an all-purpose sauce makes it sound like it's boring, but it's not at all. It's a very unusual but comforting kind of a food that's a perfect condiment to many different kinds of meat and fish and game. It's has all the good things. It's slightly sweet. It's a little bit tart. It's a nice, just all-purpose sort of a relish to have on hand. And it's easy to make with dried apples and highbush cranberries. So it's something that if you freeze your highbush cranberries, you can make it virtually any time of the year.
Some berries in Alaska have lookalikes that are dangerous or at least stomach upsetting. Is highbush cranberry one that does?
I'm glad you brought that up. There is a plant in Alaska that you will find in the interior called baneberry. And it does, if you're just starting out in this, it would be a good idea to go to a field guide and look up the picture of baneberry and then look up the picture for highbush cranberry. And once you see the difference, you won't mistake it. But the first time out, it's always a good time. That's a very good suggestion to just check yourself.
And is the baneberry going to do intense intestinal damage?
It might. Apparently, I've never eaten them, but apparently they taste terrible. And so I doubt if anyone would, even a little kid, would eat enough to make them sick. But apparently they are poisonous and so you do need to be careful about that. And highbush cranberries and baneberries grow in somewhat the same. You might possibly stumble upon them in the same habitat. So that's a good thing to know. Baneberries have a different leaf. A highbush cranberry has a maple leaf, and baneberry leaves are more segmented. So you can tell definitely from the leaf. And they're actually, I don't think anyone would have any trouble, but just to be on the safe side, it would be good to just check yourself out. And
it's not a bad idea for the tyro to take a little field guide along in the back pocket or the backpack or something.
Right. And it just also having a field guide, if you come across something that looks interesting, you can look it up in your field guide. Even if it's something that you weren't originally intending to go hunt for, you might see something along the way that, well, I wonder if that's edible. And if you have a field guide, you might end up with more treasures than you were thinking.
Very true. Deborah Marshall's preface to the book talks about cooking, talks about her pleasure in being a restaurateur. She also talks about allowing home-cooked meals, or I assume restaurant-cooked meals, to provide quality in your life. I think this is something that in the 90s, fast-paced, a little too oriented to fast food, and, oh my gosh, we're late, we've got to go, we tend to miss that quality. Have you observed or have you developed over the years ways of bringing what we think of as old-time ease around the table, quality time, back into food preparation and enjoyment?
Well, I think the restaurant does that by having candlelight on the table and a very pleasant but not overly overbearing wait staff that's there to help you and enjoy your meal, but they're not going to be, you know, pushing you to order this or that or try this or that if you really aren't interested. And I think the Fiddlehead, just by its over the years, has developed that atmosphere, that ambiance, that we're this eating is a very social event and a time to sort of take a break from the day's activities and enjoy your company and enjoy life. And the Fiddlehead, I think, has developed that, has maintained that atmosphere, even as they've gotten busier and busier. They've managed to do that, and part of it is that the customers who are there know that's the reason why they choose the Fiddlehead restaurant, is because they know that's the experience that they want, and they've managed to carry that along. I guess on a personal level, that's one of the joys of eating wild edibles, is the whole I guess you'd call it the ceremony of gathering your own food and realizing what it takes to produce it. And I think that just automatically slows you down and makes you thankful for what you have. And you also makes you want to share it with friends. You've gone out and you've worked and had all these wonderful experiences gathering your berries and fighting off the bears and catching fish, and you want to share it with your friends. And mm-hmm. I think there's something about Alaskan ingredients that just makes you want to share and give thanks.
This is Susan Brooke on Conversations Today. She has worked for a number of years in the forestry field, most recently with the Department of the Army. She has also been for the Fiddlehead Restaurant, its sous chef and a laborer in the bakery, also a supplier from her own garden for most of the fresh local foods for the Fiddlehead for a number of years. Currently, she manufactures and sells Alaskan wildberry preserves and wild edibles. Rose hips, I read in this book, are one of the richest natural sources of vitamin C in the world. I didn't know this. Mm-hmm. 60 times more than your average orange.
Right. And I think it's fair to say that native people have, of course, known this ever since ever. And it took the white people, when they first came into the country, they either caught on real fast that rose hips were a good anti-scurvy remedy, or else they got sick and they had to leave. But I think it might be fair to say that the reason why there are humans in the north is because of rose hips, that without the rose hips vitamin C, humans probably couldn't exist this far north. And I think the rose hips we deserve as humans, we all owe the rose hip a great deal.
Is there a perfect time to harvest?
Well, that
depends.
Where
the vitamin C is at its most?
That's something I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. That would be a good research project for someone here if they ever wanted to take on an interesting research project. That I don't know personally. But I do know that you can harvest them throughout the winter, and I presume that freezing would maintain the vitamin C.
You can harvest throughout the winter?
You can. They're soft and mushy. But if you're making jam or something out of them, or you can also dry the pulp too, and just sort of chew on them like wafers. So that's the mushiness isn't a problem.
Care and treatment of rose hips as you're collecting and cooking?
Well, you want to make sure that you've collected rose hips from an area that hasn't been sprayed with pesticides. That's probably number one. And if you're collecting along the road, you want to get the road dirt and fumes off them. And they have a what I call a tail. It's a part of the floral parts, but they look like a little tail, and you want to just pick those off. And they have seeds in them, quite a few rather large seeds. And that's the slow part about dealing with rose hips, is that they have these numerous seeds, and they're just big enough that they're sort of unpleasant to chew on. And so how are you going to deal with these unpleasant little seeds? And everyone has their own way of doing it. And one way would be just to extract the juice from them and just use the rose juice for jellies and syrups. That's what I do, because it's a real easy way to avoid dealing with the little seeds. But I've seen instructions that call for slitting open the rose hip and taking a knife and flicking out each of the little seeds. And you can do that, or you can mush them up in a blender, and that separates the pulp from the seeds, and that helps. But I have yet to find really a good, fast way of separating the seeds from the pulp. It's time-consuming, but the vitamin C, you just can't beat it.
And will it survive? Vitamin C will survive recreation into a syrup or into jams and jellies?
That's my impression that it will. Actually, now that I think of it, the Extension Service, I believe, has done a study of the vitamin C content, whether it's fresh or whether it's in a jelly or frozen, and I think they've shown that in almost all its forms, it's still very, very high in vitamin C.
Are there other healthiest of wild foods that come to mind for you? Hmm. Is rose hip the leader?
That's a good question. For vitamin C, I would think rose hips are hard to beat. Mushrooms, of course, have a lot of useful properties, in probably more in flavor than you know, what we might think of as a healthful medicinal property. But I actually, one thing that the early explorers knew as an anti-scurvy remedy was harvesting spruce tips, and that's something that has fallen out. For some reason, people haven't kept up that tradition of harvesting spruce tips the way some groups have kept up the tradition of harvesting rose hips. But the homesteaders, at least in Southeast, used to use, well, actually some of them still do, use the spruce tips. When I say spruce tip, what I mean is the very soft new growth of spruce trees in the spring. When they first come out, they're a different color, and the needles are real soft, and they're like a little cluster, a tight cluster. And you can use those and boil them up with water and then strain off the spruce tips and make tea out of it. And that also is a very high anti-scurvy tea, and it's also used for colds. And
What's it taste like?
It doesn't taste like much of anything, frankly. Huh. It's something that you would probably want to add honey to, or sugar, or something with a little kick to it to make it have a flavor. It has a nice refreshing taste, but it doesn't taste resiny, which mm-hmm. is what you might think. It doesn't have that resiny flavor at all. It's just sort of a nice background note to, for example, rose hips. But spruce tips are something that you can make beer out of, for example. If you add yeast, you take spruce tips, take the juice, the water, the spruce tip water, add sugar, add yeast, bottle it up, and you have spruce beer. And that's something, when you read the journals of Captain Cook, that apparently they would send crews ashore to collect spruce tips and then make spruce beer, and then they would bring that on board, and the men would drink that as an anti-scurvy remedy. And so it has a lot of historical uses. But right now we mostly use it for pancake syrup.
And I was going to ask you about spruce tip syrup. Make some spruce tip syrup here for us in the studio.
Well, this is how you make... Well, you, in where I live, the little kids go out in the spring on their ponies, and they go out to, because the branches of the spruce trees are not necessarily low to the ground, they get on their ponies and they just snap the spruce tips off with their fingers and bring it back, put them in a big pot and cover them with water, and then you bring it to a boil.
A lot?
As big as your pot is.
Okay.
If you just collect a few spruce tips, you just have a little water. Just water to cover, I guess, would be the right ingredient, the right proportion. After you've boiled them so that the spruce tips have lost their nice green color and they now look like boiled artichokes, pour off the water, separate the spruce tips from the water, and this is sort of the horrifying part, add an equal amount of sugar as you have water. So if you have a gallon of water of this spruce tip juice, you add a gallon of sugar. I know it's horrifying, but that's the recipe. And then you boil that, and it goes from an amber color to a beautiful orange color, and then it turns into a crimson color. And you just stop and taste it, and when it gets to the taste and the thickness that you want, then it's done. And if you let it boil a long time, then you call it cough syrup. And if you just stop it when it's still fairly liquid, then you can mix it into ginger ale or tonic water and make a drink out of it.
A flavored drink. How roughly long from first into the pot to syrup, let's say, which I suppose is in the middle of cough syrup and pop, right?
Right. Yeah. It depends on how big your pot is, you know, how much volume you have, but it would probably take between half an hour and an hour.
Not long.
It's a real fun, simple thing to do, and in the spring, before anything is ripe, it's a great way to go out and have a spruce tip syrup tastes like strawberries, believe it or not. It's incredible. It's this crimson-red strawberry color, and it tastes like strawberries, and strawberries won't be ripe for months, and spruce tips are the first thing that you can go out and collect and enjoy as a wild edible.
Well, now that's attractive. Strawberries before strawberries. You're listening to Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. Susan Brooke is my guest today. She and her husband, with the help of friends, built a cabin in Gustavus in southeast Alaska, about 50 miles west of Juneau. About 200 people live in and around Gustavus,
right.
Yes? And they live and work there. And as I've said, Susan manufactures and sells Alaskan wild berry products and edibles. We should pause long enough to take a look at strawberries and raspberries in our kind of mental picking here today. I understand from the book that if you quick freeze your strawberries after picking them, if you're going to put them in something that creates juice, that you're going to get a whole lot more juice out of them.
Mm-hmm.
What happens?
Why is that? The reason is because the freezing bursts the cell walls in the fruits, and it releases a lot of tied up liquid that's in the cell wall, and therefore you get about 30% more juice yield from frozen berries than you would if you just picked them fresh and extracted the juice from them when they were fresh. A frozen berry is eating out of the hand isn't nearly as enjoyable as eating a fresh berry, but when you want the juice, then freezing them is well worthwhile doing.
And not for any length of time. You just quick freeze it, pull it out, accomplish the job of breaking down the cell walls,
right.
And then you can
freezing it overnight would be sufficient.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about finding wild strawberries. Seems to me that they lie along riverbanks. Mm-hmm. Must be other places. That's where I find them.
Right, they like sunny spots, well drained soil, like along a riverbank where it might be sandy and well drained. And they're probably the first berry. They kick off the season is harvesting wild strawberries, and in southeast, and my recollection of up in Fairbanks, that they're tiny, but they're incredibly sweet, and they're just, when you find a patch of them, you might as well just drop your pack and sit down and indulge yourself, because there's probably nothing finer in the early summer than to come across a patch of wild strawberries and forage on them like bears do.
Like bears do, yes.
Right.
That's right. This is not quite related, because in this moment we're sitting down and just eating the berries as we go. But I know people have said wild berries don't need pectin. The book says that's not true.
Mm-hmm. That was one of the hardest myths that I had to give up, was I would read all my cookbooks and they'd say wild strawberry jelly doesn't require pectin. And I don't know how many gallons of strawberry syrup I have, because
right.
It never set up. And I finally realized that it wasn't, that at least in my experience in Alaska, that Alaskan strawberries almost without fail need to have added pectin made to them so they will firm up and turn into something that's you enjoy eating rather than a gummy mess, or else a syrup that is great syrup, but maybe what you really wanted was jelly.
And, right. What's the prejudice against pectin?
Well, I think that there's having been asked this question, because I do use pectin in my products because I absolutely have to have a reliable product that, and I think what it is people consider it to be an added ingredient, an additive, but in fact pectin is made from apples, and it's not, it's a very natural ingredient. And there are just, frankly, lots of fruits and vegetables that don't have natural pectin in them, and you can play with them as much as you want, and they will never gel. They'll mm-hmm. never gel. They'll always be a syrup. And if you want to use those berries or those fruits, then you're going to have to, and you want a jelly, you're going to have to add pectin. And I think it. Some people view it as a mark of being a good cook that somehow you can create this jelly without adding pectin. And
right.
and there's just some things that you just won't be able to do without pectin. But it's a perfectly natural product, and it definitely has its use in cooking.
Now, I wanted to ask you about what for me would be an unusual use for raspberries. Most of my raspberries go into jellies or on top of granola or on top of pancakes. There's a recipe for raspberry vinegar mm-hmm. in the book that sounds very tasty.
It's wonderful. Yeah, it's a real, that's another, for people, you know, such as myself, who are real interested in preserving the fruits of summer. Berry-flavored vinegars are a great way to go. There's only so much, at least for me, there's only so much jam and jelly that I can consume in a year. And yet, if you have an abundance of raspberries, you don't want to waste a single one of them. And so making them into vinegar, making a flavor of raspberry-flavored vinegar is a great way to go. It's simple. It doesn't require it doesn't require any fancy equipment. You can do it in a jug on your kitchen windowsill and just as easily as someone with stainless steel and all the latest equipment. You can do it while you're backpacking, for that matter.
So the heat of the sun, is that what you're
right.
saying?
Right, mm-hmm. The heat of the sun will speed up the process. And you can also add different herbs to it. You can really be creative with flavored vinegars. And raspberry vinegar also is used, especially, maybe not so much anymore, but the old homesteaders used to make something called raspberry shrub. It was raspberry vinegar and water, and if they had sugar, honey to taste, and it makes a really refreshing, cooling drink. And in modern days, you could add tonic water or club soda or something a little more effervescent. But raspberry shrub is made from raspberry vinegar, is a real old-timey recipe.
For those who are wondering, very quickly from the book, 3 parts wine vinegar with 1 part whole raspberries. Add a bit of sugar to the mix. Heat gently to a near boil. Let it sit. Bottle it, seal it, store it. And then you strain the raspberries out before use. All right. Best time for raspberries?
Raspberries are more of a end of the summer. This year I was picking raspberries up until frost. And they're definitely, to me, they're another end of the summer thing that I really look forward to a lot. And they're so fragile, and it's such a fleeting pleasure that they just sort of sum up almost what the Alaskan harvest and the Alaskan summer is all about. They've just concentrated all the summer sunshine into themselves, and they just are one of the gifts.
What do you know or think about bringing the wild home? Rhubarb in the garden, raspberries in the garden, fiddlehead ferns along the side of the house. What comes to mind about care and transportation and creating or selecting a medium that will be comfortable for the plant that was in the wild before?
Well, that's always a real fun thing to do, is to recreate a wild edibles garden. And part of the challenge is the fact that, for example, fiddleheads like it nice and wet and moist and shady, and raspberries, for example, like just the opposite. They like very well-drained soil and all the sunshine that they can possibly get. And so you've got to create the little microclimates that each one really prefers. And There's also a lot of what are called mycorrhizae in the soil that are, it's like a fungus that no one really pays much attention to, but some people think that that's really important for the plant to live. And if you yank the plant out of its where this mycorrhizae is and stick it in some other kind of soil, that it may just, you may love it to death, and it'll never prosper for you because it misses the little invisible goodies that were in its own native soil. And so to try and recreate those conditions is really a challenge, because you're never quite sure if you've mimicked everything just the way they like it, or you know what the missing ingredient might be. But it's a really fun thing to do, and you also, I know I have a little bit of a wild garden around my house, and if I neglect it, it seems to do just fine without me. It certainly doesn't need, you know, my help to grow and prosper.
Which is another advantage.
Yes. Right.
The iris are fine all by themselves.
Right, yes. Exactly.
I have plenty of cultivated rhubarb in my old backyard. When I was down in Valdez in last summer, we noticed a lot of wild rhubarb along the roadside. Is wild rhubarb ever going to come up to the incredible beauty, strength, and fruitiness of cultivated rhubarb? And do I treat it differently if I bring it home?
Yeah, they're actually two very different plants. They're different species, and they're not at all... They taste the same. They have that sourness about them that is a nice vehicle for sugar. But they're not at all the same critter. And so you'd have to, you know, respect one for what it is and the other for what it is. But the wild rhubarb will never be as, even if you were to transplant it and give it everything you could possibly think of, it will never be as the stalks will never be as thick as the domesticated species. It's just one of those things you just have to appreciate
for what it is.
Yeah.
And is that true for just about all the wild vegetables and fruits in this country which are domesticated in other forms? There's sweet potatoes grow in Alaska, and potatoes and celery and asparagus, and all different than the wild ones are all different than the ones we bring home.
Mm-hmm. Some plants, if you bring them home, they will be much more productive than in the wild. And there's some plants that they just are wild critters, and we don't know their secrets, and they will just resist all your best attempts at domestication. And that's part of the fun of knowing about wild edible plants, is because it just broadens your palate of what you can enjoy and learn. And it is fun to try and bring them home and domesticate them and see how they like being domesticated. Some of them don't care for it one bit.
Yeah, people are like that too. There are four authors for the Fiddlehead Cookbook. Deborah Marshall is the first. She is the primary owner, the CEO, for the Fiddlehead Restaurant and Bakery in Juneau. Nancy and John DeCherney are chefs at the Fiddlehead, and Nancy is the illustrator for the book. And Susan Brooke, our guest today on Conversations, brought her knowledge of wild native foods used as primary ingredients in the collection of Alaskan recipes. Susan, you, among other things you do, you make chutneys in your business. Tell people who don't know, what's a chutney? It seems like there are all sorts of chutneys for all sorts of purposes. Is there any one ingredient or any one definition that ties all chutneys together?
Well, I think defining chutney is fairly slippery, and the best definition that I can think of is calling a chutney a cross between a jam and a pickle, that it's sweet, and it's also sour, like a pickle, and it. That's about as far as you can go with defining chutney. It's
starts and ends right there.
Right. Some chutneys are very hot and spicy. Other chutneys are fairly mild and sort of soothing backgrounds to whatever your hot spicy food is. Other chutneys are very assertive, and they would be the hot spicy thing that you would serve something mild with to balance off. But chutneys are a real versatile condiment, and they can serve the same role as, for example, the highbush cranberry apple butter. It's something that's pretty multi-purpose, and there is no There is no such thing as the right chutney or the wrong chutney, or this is a chutney or this isn't. It's
red wine or white wine. It's how it tastes and how you like it.
Yeah.
Put together for us your favorite chutney.
Well, I make a rhubarb chutney. Speaking of wonderful old diehard rhubarb, I make a rhubarb chutney it's a fairly relaxed kind of chutney. It's not overly spicy. The spices are fairly sweet, which sort of balance off the tartness of the rhubarb, and it's chunky with some sort of a puree background. It's sort of a multi-purpose chutney that won't be too hot for your dad, but it'll be spicy enough for people who like spicy food. Chutneys are something that you'll find chutney recipes in a lot of cookbooks, and they're nice to have on hand, little jars of chutneys on hand to sort of add some pizzazz to a sort of a bland meal.
What else do you put in your rhubarb chutney?
Raisins, red wine. Sometimes I put in apples, sliced chopped apples. But it's actually fairly straightforward with just rhubarb, onions, and raisins, and then and some wine and spices.
Rhubarb chutney from Susan Brook. You mentioned mushrooms a bit ago. I think thousands of people go mushrooms. Probably tens or hundreds of thousands stay home and would never think of it because they're sure it's a sure route to the emergency ward. Can you take the fear out of mushrooming for us?
Well, I think the best way to take the fear out of mushrooming for people is to really encourage people to take mushroom classes. And I know in Fairbanks that in this probably the spring and fall that there are classes, field classes, where you go out with a very knowledgeable person and identify mushrooms with this person, the poisonous and the non-poisonous ones, because it's just as important to know what's bad to eat as it is to know what's good to eat. And that's probably the best way. If you can't sign up for a class, then another way would be to collect the mushrooms, keeping them all separate, because if you don't know which ones are good and which ones are bad, you don't want them all thrown into the same bag where they might kind of rub up against each other, and then take them to someone that you know is a good edible mushroom expert and have them identify them for you, which ones are good and which ones are bad. If you can't do that, then get the best field guide that you can for your area and go out there, and there's probably four or five mushrooms that are pretty unmistakable that are good to eat, and if you just concentrate on those, chances are you won't have any trouble. But by far the best thing is to sign up for a class or to take your mushrooms over to someone who is very knowledgeable and just have them help you identify them. But there are some excellent field guides around, and there are several mushrooms that are very good that don't look like anything else that could trip you up. And so people shouldn't have that fear. It's mushroom hunting is a well celebrated spring and fall activity, and it's one of the joys of living in an area where there's lots of woods and unspoiled areas.
Mm-hmm. Favorite things to do with mushrooms from your kitchen?
Well, it depends on the mushroom. Some mushrooms get soggy almost the second you pick them, but for example, a morel, and there's lots of morels in Fairbanks certain times of the year. To me, the finest way to serve morels is to slice them so they look like wavy little rings and saute them in butter and maybe a little garlic and pepper and a little bit of nutmeg and just have a whole heaping platter of them. It's another one of those rare treats that you can indulge in the springtime, and just, you know, you don't need much to make them really sing.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Conversations. This is KUAC-FM. I'm Susan McInnes. Today with us, Susan Brook from the Fiddlehead Restaurant and Bakery in Juneau. How much courage goes into cooking? Any at all?
I think in any art performance that it takes courage. And cooking is, as you said, is there's a lot of art involved, and there's a lot of putting yourself into it and serving it forth to your friends and family. And that there's always a certain aspect of courage involved in that, of, you know, being vulnerable to other people's comments about something that you've done. And I So I think there's an element of courage, and I think along with that, there is also an element of fun and experimentation and just knowing that if your ingredients are just the top, you have the best ingredients, and you treat them with respect and with care and simply, that chances are you just can't go wrong. That if you let the ingredients speak for themselves, that chances are you'll create a masterpiece.
Do you have favorite cookbooks or cooking guides in the kitchen? The springboard for this thought is that the Tassajara bread book took the fear out of making bread and made it into a wonderful experience, mm-hmm. Nearly therapeutic, sometimes spiritual experience. I mean, Tassajara did that. So from that example of my own life, I'm wondering if any books or any guides in your kitchen opened up a world of cooking mm-hmm. to you.
Well, I'd have to say that for me, the joy of cooking, the old classic Big Fat Cookbook that probably, you know, your mother gave you or that your mother had, to me, it was that gave me that confidence and that sense of winging it too when you didn't have all the ingredients. That, to me, that's the backbone of the cooking that I do.
It's comforting to have Irma Rombauer standing next to you, isn't it?
Yeah. Thank you, Irma.
Yes.
There's another cookbook. It's actually, she would call it a field guide, and it was just published fairly recently by Janice Schofield. And frankly, I can't remember the exact title of it, which is not very helpful, but it's...
It's roughly what?
Alaskan Edible Wild Plants, and it's a large format book, and it has a beautiful photograph of a wild onion on the cover. And she mixes food lore and Alaskan... it's an Alaskan field guide to wild plants, and she also has an incredible array of recipes that not just necessarily eating recipes, but recipes for making... cold creams for facial rubs and sort of medicinal uses. And it's just a real inspiration because to me it combines the field guide, you know, am I sure that this is what the plant is that I think it is? She goes into great detail on that. And she then presents you with some way to use it that's just really inspiring. It's unique, it's novel, it's tastes good. It is good for you. That's another cookbook that I would really recommend to anyone.
Good. For our listeners, recommendations for the cooking season. There are people who spend a lot of time over edible flowers. Are edible flowers within your field of reference?
Mm-hmm. When I was market gardening for the Fiddlehead, the edible flowers were probably one of the things that, at least from the gardener's perspective, that we enjoyed raising the most. It was such a treat to go out there in the morning and harvest all the Johnny Jump-Ups and the chive blossoms and nasturtiums and then to pack them real carefully in the box and ship them off to the Fiddlehead, and it was just such a treat to see these beautiful flowers all nicely packed and to know that when the Fiddlehead got them that they would garnish a salad or a platter. And there, I think that's another thing that Alaskans can really pay more attention to is just the wild edible flowers, the cultivated flowers and the wildflowers that are edible and add so much visually to a dish. It just creates, you can take something very mundane and add a few flowers and it just becomes a whole nother experience.
As a garnish, as an edible garnish.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, fill the imagination of some of our listeners with flowers that can be harvested for eating.
Well, one flower that we really like and that's easy to grow are nasturtiums. And I know in Fairbanks they generally just go crazy in the summer. They're just kindergarten flowers to grow, but they're so much fun. And they have... their flowers tend to be in the shades of orange and yellow and hot reds, and you can use them in a variety of different ways. You can take the petals and chop them up real fine and mix them in with butter and make nasturtium butter and spread those on little hors d'oeuvres and with a little smoked salmon on top. You can add nasturtiums in a salad just either as whole as a garnish or else take the petals and maybe chop them a little more finely and mix them in with your regular salad greens, and they have a sort of peppery, not spicy, peppery taste to them that really adds quite a bit to the salad. And the nasturtium leaves are edible too. They're peppery as well. You can take nasturtium flowers and stuff. The nasturtium flowers form kind of a cone, and you can take like a flavored cream cheese, maybe flavored with orange marmalade, and stuff the insides of the nasturtium flowers with the cream cheese mixture and put them out as an hors d'oeuvre. They're real versatile, and you can float them on soup, and they're just a wonderful flower that's easy to grow and tastes good and just look beautiful.
Very tasty. Gardeners in Fairbanks will be happy to know that chickweed is listed as an edible flower.
That's right. Surprise. There is a use for chickweed. And the leaves are very high, and they're a very healthful herb. And they taste great. When your lettuce patch is overrun with chickweed, at least you can have a salad out of chickweed.
You can't get to your lettuce. All right. Now, I want to ask you about the mother dough, about sourdough starter. It is said that sourdough starter should go with everyone who is welcoming someone to the neighborhood, people who are going into a marriage, a new home. This warms the home. If you don't have a sourdough starter, aren't starting a new home, a new marriage, or have no friends to bring you one, how can you create for yourself a sourdough starter?
Well, they give a recipe in the cookbook. There's actually, sourdough will almost start itself. It take flour and water. The simplest sourdough starter that I know of, and which is the primal sourdough starter, is simply flour and water. And the natural yeasts in the air, which are everywhere around us, will of course get into the flour and water mixture and create a sourdough starter. And that's the simplest form of sourdough starter that you can possibly have. If you want to encourage it, you can add some sugar to the flour and water mixture. Some people boil potatoes and add the potato cooking water to the sourdough mixture. There's lots of ways to sort of give it a boost and help it along, but the simplest way is just to flour and water and let nature run its course, and you'll have a good sourdough starter.
Now, the book says don't put in commercial grocery store yeast.
You don't...
Unhealthy for your sourdough starter.
Well, it's certainly not needed, I'm not sure what all is in commercial yeast to know how the wild yeasts, which are in our air, and the commercial yeasts would, whether they'd get along or whether they would not get along, and then you'd end up with some kind of a rotten, ucky mess. But you certainly don't need commercial yeast. And some people think it's cheating to have yeast in your sourdough bread. But it does, if you're pressed for time, that's certainly a way to speed things up, is to take your sourdough starter and then your regular flour and add a little yeast.
Now, I read in the Fiddlehead Cookbook that sourdough starter tastes differently in different parts of the country.
That's because the yeasts in the air are different from area to area. Yeasts are like plants or animals, that there's different varieties depending on where you live, and scientists can take yeast and tell you where this yeast came from. Well, this yeast grows in the West Coast, this yeast grows in Alaska, this yeast grows in Arizona. And so that's why when you buy sourdough bread from San Francisco, if it's true, uh-huh, authentic sourdough, it'll taste different than the sourdough bread that you would make here in Alaska. You're just dealing with a different critter.
What's your favorite wild edible these days? We have moments left, and I was trying to think of what tickles your fancy the most about the work that you're doing.
Boy, that's a hard question. I think for me, I'd almost have to answer it, what's my favorite edible in the spring? What's my favorite edible in the, early summer, late summer, and in the fall? If I can be allowed to do that.
Yes.
My favorite edible in early spring is probably morel mushrooms. I think that's hard to top. They just are so earthy and just so glorious after eating dried food. So I think early spring, it's morels. In early summer, I'd have to say it's wild strawberries, that the little tiny jewels that you see, nestled amongst the leaves. That's such a treat when you're out camping in the early summer. Sort of mid to late summer, I'd say raspberries. That to me, they're just the queen of the berry. And then in late summer, for me, it's high bush cranberries. They're, to me, they sort of sum up the essence of fallen leaves, and this is time to get everything harvested for the winter. They just tell that to me, and so I think those are my favorites throughout the year.
I wonder about the musky scent of high bush. It always tells me that winter is coming and the fall list has to be gotten out. Does it do the same thing for you?
It definitely does. And I think that's why, because I harvest them, that I have all that smell that is so evocative, and that stays with me. Though I will have to say that I know a lot of people who, once they smell high bush cranberries being cooked, that just ruins it from them, because that skunky, musty smell stays with them, and they can't get beyond that. So it depends, but for me, that musty smell just sums up the autumn, and that's important to me to know that summer is coming to a close.
Mm-hmm. Susan Brook has been our guest. The Fiddlehead Cookbook, Recipes from Alaska's Most Celebrated Restaurant and Bakery, says on the title of the book. It is a book, or on the front page of the book. It is a book by Nancy and Don DeCherney, chefs, Deborah Marshall, owner, Susan Brook, brought into the mix for her knowledge of wild edibles. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. Is there a last edible thought for our listeners today, I wonder?
Well, that everyone thinks that in Alaska in the winter that we all eat freezer-burned moose meat and pilot bread. And I guess the joy of living in Alaska is that you have all this incredible bounty in the summer. And it's a very nice thing to do in Alaska, is to preserve the bounty of the summer, so that we can have it to eat in the winter.
Is your freezer full of salmon and berries?
Yeah, my freezer's full to overflowing, and also the larder with pickles and chutneys and sauces and things like that.
How are what I think of as the odd pickles, if you think about, say, bull seaweed from...
Kelp pickles.
Yeah, kelp pickles. Right. Those aren't going to give me what I think of as a pickle taste. Once again, this is something all its own.
Kelp pickles, at least the way we make them in Southeast, is you can take the kelp, and it basically provides a crunchy background for the pickling brine. You can make kelp pickles using like a bread and butter pickle brine, using a mustard brine, and the kelp just provides the crunchiness and the texture for the brine. If you were to cook to slice them so that they looked like just a little stick.
Pickle chip.
I'm sure you could easily fool your cousin from the Midwest into thinking that, yes, these were cucumbers or these were watermelon rinds. They're just a versatile crunchy.
Cooking with Imagination, from Gustavus, Alaska to Fairbanks. Thank you very much, Susan Brook, for being on Conversations.
My pleasure
to talk with you. And I hope you'll join me again next Sunday. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations.